the top of the Empire State Building. Best Equity Business Podcast is back.
We back.
Expansion always, in all ways. Eye-opening episodes, sales, marketing strategies, entrepreneurial development, the everyday entrepreneur experience. So get ready to network to build your net worth. You're now listening to the Pest Equity Business Podcast.
Welcome all and welcome back to another great episode of Pest Equity Business Podcast. I'm your host. Today on episode number 56, as well as our first episode ever of 2023, I want to wish you all a happy new year to begin with. And I want to discuss crafting a profitable service business in 2023. Can it be done? And what's your best options? As the world's major economies have matured, they have become dominated by service-focused businesses. But many of the management tools and techniques that service managers use today were designed to tackle the challenges of product companies. So the question on today's episode is, are these tools and techniques sufficient, or do we need new ones? Let me first state that some new tools are definitely necessary. When a business takes a product to market, whether it's a basic commodity like cereal or a highly engineered offering like a digital camera, the company must make the product itself compelling and also feel the workforce capable of producing it at an attractive price. To be sure, neither job is easy to do. Enormous amounts of management, attention, and academic research have been devoted to these challenges. But delivering a service entails something else as well: the management of customers, who are not simply consumers of the service, but can also be integral to its production. And because customers' involvement as producers can wreak havoc on costs, service companies must also develop creative ways to fund their distinctive advantages. Now, any of these four elements that we're going to discuss, the offering or its funding mechanism, the employee management system, or the customer management system, can be the undoing of a service business. This is demonstrated by my research of service companies that have struggled over the past decade. What is just as clear, however, is that there is no right way to combine the elements that we will discuss. The appropriate design of many of them depends upon the other three. So when we look at service businesses that have grown and prospered, it is their effective integration of the elements that stands out more than cleverness of any element in isolation. This episode is geared for learning how crafting a profitable service business based on these critical elements called the service model. This approach recognizes the differences between service businesses and product businesses. On this episode, I want you to think about those differences and their implications for management practice. Above all, I want you to take away and learn that to build a great service business, managers must get the core elements of service design pulling together, or else risking pulling the business apart. So let's begin with the offering. The challenge of service business management begins with design. As with product companies, a service business can't last long if the offering itself is fatally flawed. It must effectively meet the needs and desires of an attractive group of customers. In thinking about the design of a service, however, managers must undergo an important shift in perspective. Whereas product designers focus on the characteristics buyers will value, service designers do better to focus on the experiences customers want to have. Let me give you an example. Customers may attribute convenience or friendly interaction to your service brand. They may compare your offering favorably with competitors because of extended hours, closer proximity, greater scope, or lower prices. Your management team must be absolutely clear about which attributes of service the business will compete on. Strategy is often defined as what a business chooses not to do. Similarly, service excellence can be defined as what a business chooses not to do well. If this sounds odd, it should. Rarely do we advise that the path to excellence is through inferior performance. But since service businesses usually don't have the luxury of simply failing to deliver some aspects of their service, every physical store must have employees on site. For example, even if they're not particularly skilled or plentiful, most successful companies choose to deliver a subset that package poorly. They don't make this choice casually. Instead, my research has shown they perform badly at some things in order to excel at others. This can be considered a hard-coded trade-off. Think about the company that can offer to stay open for longer hours because it charges more than the competition. This business is excelling on convenience and has relatively inferior performance on price. The price dimension fuels the service dimension. Service excellence can be defined as what a business chooses not to do well. To create a successful service offering, managers need to determine which attributes to target for excellence and which to target for inferior performance. These choices should be heavily informed by the needs of your customers. Managers should discover the relative importance customers place on attributes and then match the investment in excellence with those priorities. At any big box stores, for example, ambience and the sales help are least valued by its customers. Low prices and wide selection are most valued, and several other attributes rank at points in between that. The trade-offs made are deliberately informed by these preferences. The company optimizes specific aspects of its service offering to cater to its customers' priorities, and it refuses to overinvest in underappreciated attributes. The fact that it takes a beating from competitors on things its customers are less about drives its overall performance. The phenomenon, of course, has a circular aspect. Shoppers whose preferences match strengths self-select into its customer base. Meanwhile, those who don't prefer these attributes buy elsewhere. It is important, therefore, to identify customer segments in terms of attribute preferences, or as some marketers prefer to say, in terms of customer needs. Identifying what might be called customer operating segments is not the same exercise as traditional psychographic segmentation. Rather than stressing differences that enable increasingly targeted and potent messaging, this type of segmentation aims to find populations of customers who share a notion of what constitutes excellent service. Once an attractive customer operating segment is found, the mission is clear. Management should design a new offering or tweak an existing one to line up with that segment's preferences. Look, for example, at the fit achieved by banks, think about it, which has been able to grow its retail customer base dramatically, even though its rates are among the worst in its markets, and it has made limited acquisitions. Most banks focus on the set of customers who care about the experience of visiting a physical branch. These customers come in all shapes and sizes, from young first-time banking clients to time-strapped professionals to elderly retirees. As an operating segment, however, they all believe that convenience is a bank's most important attribute and choose their bank because of its evening and weekend hours. Second most important to them is the friendliness of interaction with employees. And so the promise of a cheerful, familiar teller has become part of the bank's core offering. Not to mention, these banks have added to its branches ambience with interior elements. For example, high ceilings, natural light. When it comes to attributes less important to the bank's customers, price and product range management is willing to cede the battle to competitors. It is tempting to think, if I'm a really good manager, then I don't have to cede anything to the competition. This well-intentioned logic can lead, ironically, to not excelling at anything. The only companies I've seen that are superior at most service attributes demand a price premium of 50% over their competitors. Most industries don't support this type of premium, and so trade-offs are necessary. I like to tell managers that they are choosing between excellence paired with inferior performance on one hand and mediocrity across all dimensions on the other. When managers understand that inferior performance in one dimension fuels superior performance in another, the design of excellent service is not far behind. Let's move on to the funding mechanisms. All managers and even most customers agree that there is no such thing as a free lunch. Excellence comes at a cost, and the cost must ultimately be covered. With a tangible product, a company's mechanism for funding superior performance is usually relatively simple. The price tag. Only the customer who forfeits the extra cash can avail themselves of the premium offering. In the service business, developing a way to fund excellence can be more complicated. See, many times, pricing is not transaction-based, but involves the bundling of various elements of value or entails some kind of subscription, such as a monthly fee. In these cases, buyers can extract uneven amounts of value for their money. Indeed, even non-buyers may derive value in certain service environments. For example, a shopper might spend time learning from a knowledgeable salesperson only to leave the store empty-handed. In a service business, therefore, management must give careful thought to how excellence will be paid for. There must be a funding mechanism in place to allow the company to outshine competitors in the attributes it has chosen. In my study of successful service businesses, I've seen the funding mechanism take four basic forms. Two are ways of having the customer pay, and two cover the cost of excellence with operational savings. Charge the customer in a palatable way. The classic approach to funding something of value is simply to have the customer pay for it. But often it's possible to make the form that payment takes less objectionable to customers. Rarely is that done with the a la carte pricing for the niceties. A large part of coffee shops' appeal is that a customer can linger almost indefinitely in a coffee house setting. It's unthinkable that would place meters next to its overstuffed chairs. A better way to fund the atmosphere is to charge more for the coffee. Certain banks are open late and on weekends, earning it high marks on extended hours, and it pays for that service by giving half percentage points less in interest on deposits. Could it fund the extra labor hours by charging for evening and weekend visits? Perhaps, but a slightly lower interest rate is more palatable. Management in any setting would do well to creatively consider what feels fair to its customers. Often the least creative solution is to charge more for the particular service feature you are funding. Create a win-win. between operational savings and value-added services. Very clever management teams discover ways to enhance the customer's experience even while spending less, finding, in other words, that there can be such a thing as a free lunch. Many of these innovations provide only a temporary competitive advantage as they are quickly recognized and copied by everyone. An example is the immediate response service provided by insurance companies. When someone insured is involved in an auto accident, the company immediately sends out a van to assist that person and to assess the damage on the spot, often arriving on the scene before the police or a tow truck. Customers love this level of responsiveness and give the company high marks for service. But in anticipation of such a need someday, would they pay more in insurance premiums? That's the question. Unfortunately, no. People are pathologically price sensitive about car insurance and almost never select anything but the rock bottom quote. The key to insurance companies' ability to fund this service is the cost savings it ultimately yields. Normally, insurance providers are subject to fraud, with criminals making claims for accidents that were staged or never happened. Because of these other types of dispute claims, firms also incur high legal fees, which combined with the other cost of fraud add up to some $15 out of every $100 in insurance premiums across the industry, from my research. Since deploying its vans has seen costs in both categories plummet, sending a company representative to the scene pays for itself. Insurance companies offer another customer convenience that many competitors have so stayed away from. Giving quotes from other providers alongside its own when a potential buyer inquires about the cost of insurance. It's not that it's determined to go one better than rivals to win the business. In fact, it's the lowest quote only about half the time. What they believe is that its quote is the right one given the probability of that person's getting into an accident, a probability that the insurer is best in class at determining. If indeed his quote is spot on, then allowing a competitor to insure the customer at a lower rate is doubtably effective. It frees the company from a money-losing proposition while burdening its competitors with the unprofitable account. That's a level of service that looks downright altruistic to its customer, actually benefits the company. This is an example of leveraging operations into a value-added service. If a self-service option is truly preferable, customers should be willing to take on the work for nothing or even pay for the privilege. So the question is, how can your management team find win-win solutions of its own? Whenever I pose these questions to managers, their impulse is to imagine what new value could be created for customers and then to ponder how that could be funded through cost savings. I suggest beginning instead by asking, where are our biggest cost buckets? With these in mind, managers can simultaneously determine how to reduce costs and create a value-added service. A good first place to look, you might ask, anywhere that time is a large component of cost. Removing time is often fruitful since it can directly improve service even as it cuts costs. Like I always say, spend now to save later. Often it is possible, if somewhat painful, to make operational investments that will pay you off eventually by reducing customers' needs for auxiliary service in the future. Let's touch upon the employee management system. Companies often live or die on the quality of their workforces, but because service businesses are typically people-intensive, a relative advantage in employee management has all the more impact there. top management must give careful attention to recruiting and selection processes, training, job design, performance management, and other components that make up the employee management system. More to the point, the decisions made in these areas should reflect the service attributes the company aims to be known for. To design a well-integrated employee management system, start with two simple diagnostic questions. The first question, what makes our employees reasonably able to achieve excellence? And then, what makes our employees reasonably motivated to achieve excellence? Thoughtfully considered, the answers will translate into company-specific policies and programs. Companies that neglect to connect the dots between their employee management approaches and customers' service preferences will find it very hard to honor their service promises. Let me share this story with you. At one company we recently consulted on, a senior manager had come to a depressing realization. She told me, "Our service stinks." Now, under our guidance, they took various measures, mainly centering on incentives and training, but the problem persisted. Customer experience in several of their branches did not improve. Perplexed but determined, the executive decided to take our recommendations and become a frontline employee herself for 1 month, like undercover boss style. We thought it would take that much time to experience a typical range of service interaction and see the roots of the problem. But in fact, it only took a couple of days. What I witnessed was, from the time the phone lines opened, customers were yelling. What becomes clear was the employees were set up to fail. Recent cross-selling initiatives had created a set of customers with more complex needs and higher expectations for their relationships with the company. But employees had not been equipped to respond. As a result of decisions made by the management team, the typical employee did not have a reasonable chance of succeeding. The employee management system was broken. If your business requires heroism of your employees to keep customers happy, then you have bad service by design. Employee self-sacrifice is rarely a sustainable resource. Instead, design a system that allows the average employee to thrive. This is part of a competitive formula. Think about that bank that chooses to compete on extended hours and friendly interactions and not on low price and product. Now think how that strategy can inform employee management. The implications are not hard to imagine. For instance, we concluded that it didn't require straight-A students to master its limited product set. It could hire for attitude and train for service. In job interviews, its managers could use simple weed-out criteria like, does this person smile in a resting state? Rather than trying to maximize across a wide range of positive characteristics. The current employees could be deployed as talent scouts on the principle that it takes one to know one. When people from your company see someone providing great service in another setting, whether at a restaurant or a daycare, they hand out a card printed with a compliment and a suggestion to consider working for your company. It's a simple reality that employees who are above average in both attitude and aptitude are expensive to employ. They are not only attractive to you, but also attractive to your competitors, which drives up wages. A business that wants to maintain a competitive cost structure will probably need to compromise on one quality or the other. Or if it insists on having both, find a way to fund that luxury. If you choose to hire for attitude, then you must engineer things so that even lower aptitude employees will reliably deliver great service. like managers who don't want to admit that their service is designed to be inferior on some attributes, many people are reluctant to acknowledge a trade-off between aptitude and attitude. A failure to accommodate this economic reality in the design of the employee management system is a common culprit in flawed service. And finally, the customer management system. In a service environment, employees aren't the only people affecting the cost and quality of service delivered. The customer themselves can be involved in operational processes, sometimes to a very large extent, and their input influences their experiences and often other customers as well. For example, an architectural firm's client may explain the purpose of a new facility well or poorly, and that will affect the efficiency of the design process and the quality of the end product. Customer involvement in operations has profound implications for management because it alters the traditional role of the business in value creation. The classic product-based business buys materials and adds value to them in some way. The enhanced value product is then delivered to customers who pay to receive it. In a service business, however, employees and customers are both part of the value creation process. A main benefit is that customer labor can be far less expensive than employee labor. It can also lead to better service experiences. When students participate more in a classroom environment, for example, they learn more. Designing a system that explicitly manages these challenges is essential to service success. Integrating the elements. Successful service companies have a working plan that incorporates all four elements we discussed of service design. Within each of these areas, however, it is hard to spot any best practice. This is because the whole business depends more on the interconnection of the four rather than any one element. Great service companies are almost without exception very clever about selecting their customers. From my experience over the years, it convinces me that the best means of sustaining growth in a service business is to employ the multi-focused model. Yet it is also evident that this model requires concentrated effort. I want to thank you all for tuning in to another great episode of Pest Equity Business Podcast. I want to thank everyone who follows us over on Instagram. If you haven't, go follow us on Instagram. Give us a like over on Facebook. Come and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're also on Twitter, if that's your thing. And we will see you all on the next episode. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to another great episode of Pest Equity Business Podcast. Be sure to share, like, and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram at Pest Equity Podcast. Join the Facebook group and go subscribe to our growing YouTube community. Have a question or topic for the show? Want to be a guest on the show? Shoot us an email at pestequitypodcast@gmail.com.